Welcome to the Republican Professor. This morning we have Dr. Greg Ganzel. And with us from frozen California, we have, what am I calling you today? Adam Stoll is what your Adam, name says.
Sure.
Professor Adam that. Stoll.
Yeah.
So, Greg, you're in California as well?
Yep.
Good to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Is that your office behind you?
My office. It's a metaphor for my brain. Very
funny. is that at school?
Yes. I'm in my office at Talbot School of Theology.
Okay. Biola University in Los Angeles County.
Yeah.
And Adam, you're in California?
Yes. We're coming from Southern California here, and just good to be here.
Well, we have invited Greg on to talk about his recent work on Nietzsche and Jesus. That's what he's working on. But maybe we should introduce Greg a little bit. So, Greg, you have a very interesting background. Where did you go to college?
Well, I did undergraduate at the University of Maryland, College Park, right outside of D.C. Mm-hmm. And then joined the staff of CRU, Campus Crusade, right after that. And which is kind of how I stumbled into philosophy, was doing campus ministry. And worked on a bunch of campuses. And then decided I had to pursue more academic philosophy. Do you want me to tell the whole story? I can tell the whole story.
Sure.
It could take like an hour. It's really boring.
Does it have pictures? Does it have pie charts and statistics?
It should have pie charts.
Okay. Right? As long as it has facts.
A pie chart. How much of my time did I put into my work and how much was I reading on the spot? Right? So I never studied philosophy as an undergraduate. I was a secondary education in biology major, and I didn't study at all. I was a horrible student. And so when I got interested in the kinds of questions that come up when you're working in campus ministry, and this began even when I was still an undergraduate, I read like crazy. So I would skip my classes to read Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis. And these kinds of people who were influential, shaping my thought. And but I had no idea I was reading philosophy. That took me a few years to think, oh my gosh, I think this is philosophy. So I started taking undergraduate classes. My first one, I was 25, and I took Intro to Philosophy. And each time I did this, I just got more and more interested. So when Jeannie and I got married in 85, we moved to Rhode Island, where we worked at Brown University in Providence. I started to pursue my master's degree at the University of Rhode Island, which is on the other side of the state. But because it's a small state, it wasn't a long drive.
And it's not actually an island.
It's not actually an island. There are lots of islands. LA County is over four times as large as the state of Rhode Island, square miles.
Wow. That's how small. Really? I didn't know that.
I just Googled it because we were wondering about it the other day.
Wow.
So
that puts it in perspective.
And by the time I did that work, it took me 5 years to do my MA because I did one class a semester. I was
in philosophy.
Well, sometimes I tell people, yeah, philosophy. Philosophy is like heroin. You know, if you take a little bit, you get hooked and you just need more. So I did my PhD at Syracuse and then finished in 95. That was a great experience. And awesome. Then we moved to Connecticut, where Jeannie and I and some of our friends involved with CRU launched the Rivendell Institute at Yale, which is still going. And I'm still on the board and I spent 20 years there. And what we did there was we worked with graduate students and faculty, mostly helping to think of how does the Christian picture of reality intersect with the work of academics, both research and teaching. Along the way, some weird doors opened, and I got to, for about 5 years, I was able to be a teaching assistant in the philosophy department at Yale. And then after that, for about 10 years, I was a part-time instructor. I generally taught one course a semester for about 10 years. And that was a great experience.
And Yale, is that a community college?
It is. There's quite a community there. And
it's a technical institute.
It was technical.
You were teaching refrigeration technology and gun repair or something.
No, that would
like
be too hard. I couldn't do that. The course I mostly taught was a kind of part of a great books curriculum. And cool. Which had a philosophy track. And so it was history of philosophy.
Oh, that's cool.
I learned so much.
I bet.
And it was a really fun, friendly department. Mm. And so that was very formative for me.
That's awesome. How big were your classes? How many students at Yale?
At Yale, the program was there were about 120 students in the total program.
Wow, that's a lot.
And I would have 17 or 18 of them each semester. So there were 7 faculty teaching the philosophy track each semester. And once a week, we would meet in a big lecture with everybody. And then twice a week in our small groups where most of the work was done. So it was seminar discussion. But then once a week there was a lecture, and that rotated among the faculty who were part of the program.
Cool. Excellent. So when did you come out to California then?
In 2015.
Okay.
Right. The job opened at Talbot. And of course we knew the philosophy department at Talbot. Some of these people have been friends for many, many, many years. And, my ability to teach at Yale, they stopped hiring part-time people. It was some administrative budget cut, which made the philosophy department pretty mad because they really wanted me. And they argued on my behalf, which I appreciated. And when that wasn't happening anymore, I realized I really wanted to have teaching as a part of my work. Mm. And so this opportunity opened, and I love the program here. I love what the goals, the people.
Yes.
So it's a great place for me.
And Greg, you have written some books, right?
A few. Yeah.
Can you tell us about the first book you wrote and how that came to be? And
The first book I wrote is called Thinking About God, First Steps in Philosophy. And it's a pretty low level introduction. And I wrote it because I began to write it because in Connecticut, my kids went to a Christian K-12 school, and they gave us a great financial aid package. So in order to help the school out, I went down and I taught a philosophy class one day a week. And we read Descartes and people like that. And I kind of ran out of stuff to do. So I started doing philosophy of religion, and I began to write up my notes. And that's what became this book. It was published in 2004. And it's philosophy of religion, but it's also an introduction in how to do philosophy. So I talk about, you know, the nature of an argument and how to reason well. So the book gets used a fair bit. You know, yeah. I use it in some of my undergraduate classes here. And then in 2009, I published a book with Baylor University Press on the new atheists, right? And what I was interested in then, that's called, I have to remember, Reasonable God.
Okay.
Engaging the New Face of Atheism. And what I was interested in then is engaging their arguments for atheism. I didn't engage arguments like Christianity has been bad for civilization or anything like that, which is a substantial charge that needs answering. Mm-hmm. Just the arguments for atheism. And I wanted to take them very seriously. So it's actually very charitable. I try to put their arguments in the best context and engage them. And people have said that one's pretty helpful. And then cool. Along the way, I edited a couple of books too. But then my latest one is called Our Deepest Desires, How the Christian Story Fulfills Human Aspirations.
That sounds cool. I don't think I've seen that one yet.
Yeah, that's 2017. What I was trying to do there is I think most people hold a sentence like this to be true. I'm pretty sure Christianity is false, and it's good that it's false. And in this book, I'm not going after the first part of the sentence, but the second part. And I'm trying to help people recognize that many of the things we care most deeply about fit into the Christian story really well and don't fit into atheistic stories as well. It's not that they're impossible if atheism is true, but they fit right into the Christian story. Things like personhood. All of our values are around personhood, human beings. And well, it makes sense on the Christian story because God is personal. And so the foundational reality is personal. Personhood is not just something accidental. And anyway, so that's kind of the line I pursue in that one.
Awesome.
And I just That's edited awesome. A book. Well, it just came out on an academic book, Philosophical Essays on Divine Causation.
But that sounds like a mouthful.
It is.
Say that title again.
Philosophical Essays on Divine Causation. So okay. I'm really happy with it, but it's the kind of book nobody's going to read.
Well, if you put pictures in it.
Yeah. Well,
I usually flip through and if I see like some quotes. Mm-hmm. And you know, like some pie charts or you know,
you like
graphs. I also like the building, the graphs. They can go sideways too, up and down. If I see that, I know it's got facts in it.
Yeah,
and I know it's probably based on facts.
Yeah,
so that's how I do it. And
that's how you do it. Well, you know, don't save up your money for this one. It's not going to help you.
So your recent work. How did you get into Nietzsche and Jesus?
Yeah, you know, I'm happy to talk about that. My training is in analytic philosophy. And when I was in grad school, there was not a lot of respect among analytic philosophers, at least the grad students I hung around with the continental tradition. And I think that's changed somewhat. But, didn't know anything about continental philosophy. And so the distinction between analytic and continental is kind of about what happens after Kant, the 19th and 20th century.
Yes.
Analytic philosophy really gets going at the end of the 19th century with people like Frege and Bertrand Russell, who are actually picking up a thread from Kant. How do we know the truths of arithmetic and geometry? And so in their exploration, Frege basically invented modern symbolic logic. And Russell built on Frege's logic. And the early Wittgenstein was part of this. And this set the tone for English-speaking philosophy, partly because when Hitler came to power, a lot of these people had to scatter Central Europe and wound up in England and America teaching in philosophy departments. And that's why analytic philosophy has a premium on things like rigorous reasoning and the primacy of logic. Now, in the last 40 or 50 years, analytic philosophers realize they don't have to turn everything into a logical syllogism, but there's still a premium on investigating very small chunks and doing it very clearly. Now the continental tradition comes up after Kant And some of this happened before Kant, so I'm giving.
And Kant is a 1780s, is something like that.
1780s. He died in 1804, so his major works were 1780s and 1790s.
Roughly contemporaneous with founding fathers and all that stuff here, right?
Yes.
Just to give people a sense for where when this is happening.
Where we are now. Kant had almost no influence, I think, on the founding fathers. I mean, they reached far a little farther back into Locke.
Probably not many of them read German. I don't know how accessible he was in English.
I'm not sure he was translated in English for a while.
Yeah,
so and his German was
we dodged a bullet on that one, maybe.
Yeah, I know. they used to say that German philosophy students would learn English in order to read Kant in translation because it was easier.
I've heard that too.
That's just kind of the urban legend.
I've heard that too.
But you get things like romanticism in 19th, you know, which began before Kant, but emerged in 19th century, early 19th century German. You get people like Hegel, what's called German idealism, and it's these big theories of everything. And that emerges, the short version is, into the 20th century, you get existentialism and you get certain kinds of what people call postmodernism, deconstruction with Jacques Derrida and Foucault and these people. So there's this thread of philosophical thought that's centered mostly in Germany and France. That's why it's called continental. And anyway, this is all background. I'm sorry for the tangent. So I had no idea about continental philosophy, except I like Kierkegaard, right? The Danish Christian thinker who's really fun. And I read a little bit of existentialism. But so in this class I was teaching at Yale in the spring, we spent a week on Nietzsche's book, The Genealogy of Morality. And as I'm reading the genealogy, I was also reading in my personal life the Gospel of John from the New Testament. And there's a place in the beginning of the genealogy in the preface where Nietzsche makes it very clear that his fundamental criteria for thinking about whether morality is valuable is, does it hinder life or does it enhance life? And at the same time, in the Gospel of John, I'm bumping into the term life everywhere, 30 times.
Oh, yeah.
The word life is used either by Jesus or about him.
Big time.
In terms of what he's doing, what he's about. It's probably the dominant metaphor in the Gospel of John. Mm-hmm. It's a gospel of life. And I thought, isn't this interesting? They're both talking about fullness of life. And yet they have very different visions. So it was that thought that triggered this. And so I started poking around in Nietzsche, which is a long process.
Yeah.
And I thought, I want to write a book tentatively called Life, Death, and Freedom, Jesus Questions Nietzsche.
Mm. But so you're treating Jesus as a philosopher, right?
Yes, yes.
That's a key thing.
Yes.
So how do you treat Jesus as a philosopher? What's the methodology for that? Is there a warrant for doing that?
Well, I think there is warrant for doing that. I think he's not just a philosopher.
Yes, right.
At least a philosopher. And he's not a philosopher in the sense that he's trying to come up with a systematic picture of reality. The picture of reality, okay, Jesus comes on the scene with, of course, is the theistic picture in Judaism, right? God is the ultimate reality. And much of Jesus' teaching was not primarily philosophical. It is, how do we know God? How do we live one with another? And
so it's got philosophical relevance, but it's not.
It's not life.
Yes, exactly. It's not like reading Frege or even St. Augustine.
But right, I think it, if
right.
we
it's closer to Augustine, right?
Yeah, are you gonna I think if we use, you know, just philosophers throughout history as kind of a useful way to look at the paradigm of what it means to be a philosopher. I mean, Confucius is considered a philosopher, and he doesn't do anything that's necessarily advanced analytic metaphysics or anything like that. So, you know, I think in that case, Jesus certainly does qualify as a philosopher at the very minimum in the historical sense.
Yeah, but, Adam, I think you're exactly right. Now, it's only really the analytic philosophers that started taking bite-sized chunks and analyzing them really precisely. Mm-hmm. You know, so Frege, for example, was interested in, can arithmetic be reduced to logic?
Right.
And he that was the only thing he was interested in, basically.
Yeah.
He wasn't thinking about a vision of how we live.
Yeah, it seems like
the continental tradition has been much more about how do human beings live. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. Well, it just seems like the birth of the analytic movement was also, in a way, the death of the big, the system builder philosopher model.
Very much.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you can't build a system in one little journal article.
You know, it's there's a book by Douglas Grotius, who teaches at Denver Seminary, was one of my professors, actually, called On Jesus. It's a little book published by Wadsworth. It's a secular academic publisher, and it treats Jesus as a philosopher. Yeah. Let me see if I have a copy of it.
Yeah, I have one. I think in recent years, Grotius was the first person to do that.
Yeah, I believe so too.
Yeah, and it's really important. Now I'm a big fan of his, but it's really important to do this kind of project. Another guy just published a book on Jesus as a philosopher, a guy named, I think, Jordan Pennington.
Okay.
And here's which I book. Haven't been able to, there it is. Yeah, exactly.
On Jesus. Now, I have to warn you, there's no pictures.
No, but it's in a series about philosophers. So
that cover art is amazing. Frege,
on Hume, on Kant. And I thought it was brilliant of him to get this into that.
Yeah, that's right. I thought so, too. The title, the table of contents, the first chapter is, Was Jesus a Philosopher?
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got chapters on Jesus' use of argument, Jesus' metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, and his view of women.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. It's out of print, I believe. So if you get a copy, you can get a copy on eBay. Snatch it up.
I think shortly after it came out, I thought I've got to get this one.
Yeah. That's your project, and it's very interesting, the fact that you're contrasting those two figures, because Nietzsche, for me, is kind of a joy to read sometimes.
Yes.
I mean, he's totally crazy, I think, on a lot of things, but I if I can figure out what he's saying, but he's such a wonderful writer, though.
Yes.
And it might sound heretical to say that in certain audiences, but if you haven't read him, you don't know. He really is a very wonderful, effective writer. He's rhetorically, he's very skilled.
Very skilled rhetorically.
He's got a lot of energy.
Yeah.
He's very dynamic, which is opposed to, I guess, how he was in real life, right? Isn't that right?
Well, the story is he was pretty gentle, not bombastic. He wasn't an angry kind of person in his personal relations. Now, he found it very difficult to keep friends. And so he had lots of friends that he wound up splitting with. So, you know, there are some personality things that he might not be the guy you want to go on vacation with. But the kinds of things he talks about in his writing, say, for example, will to power you know, as a driving force, could lead you to expect that he was kind of all about his own power. And
is that what that book is about? What's that book about?
Well, actually, the book that's published, Will to Power, is really problematic because it came from Nietzsche's sister, who, when he collapsed into insanity, she had control of his unpublished work, and she edited what we now, that book, Will to Power, and published it shortly after he died, her first edition, and she edited it in such a way to make Nietzsche look like an anti-Semite, because she was an anti-Semite. And so it really, even though it contains fragments from Nietzsche's unpublished writings, they're chosen, and I think, I'm not sure I know this, some of them are kind of twisted into portraying a view of Nietzsche that wasn't really accurate.
And
I've read that. So,
interesting.
So one of the interpretive questions for Nietzsche is, I mean, how important is his unpublished work? And commentators disagree about this. So people like Heidegger, who gave lectures on Nietzsche, thought the unpublished work was most important. And I just started reading a chapter from a guy named, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Schacht. And he thinks Will to Power is really important. Others think really the published work is what's most important. And that's kind of the direction I would go. But you get kind of different accounts of what he's about, depending on how you weigh these things. So writing about Nietzsche is fraught with difficulties. It's like being in a minefield.
Yeah.
Because everybody cares and everybody has their views about him.
Yeah.
And I'm not a scholar. I don't read German, so I can't pretend to be a Nietzsche scholar. So I'm taking a long time to develop this because I'm trying to be responsive to the secondary literature and make moderate and wise choices about how I'm going to read them. That's what takes so long.
Adam, have you read Nietzsche?
A little bit, and I can confirm that problem of interpretation, and it seems there's not just Nietzsche, there's Nietzsche's.
Yes.
Right? There's more than one, again, depending on who's got his hands. And as far as that, the literature, I think, I would be very concerned if someone published my notes as being emblematic of my thought.
Yes.
Because those notes are all just, they're just unrefined bits, and maybe you can use them as seeds for, you know, other inquiry, but I wouldn't think of it in terms of the kind of work that I think would be worthy of someone, you know, investigating or taking seriously. And so I think I do side with Greg on this, that to lean towards what he intended to publish as more emblematic of Nietzsche's work.
Yeah.
So I understand that interpretive difficulty, but it also gives you a little bit of latitude as well, I think, to take it directions you might not otherwise. And as far as like the I was, I think, an existentialist type of person when I first started in philosophy. Mm-hmm. I was someone who was interested in the existentialists. In one of my first classes, I think my second semester of a philosophy major, I was in an existentialism class. Mm-hmm. And it was like rewarding and unusual and fraught kind of all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the best writers in the history of philosophy are in the continental tradition.
Yes.
And you find often the people who really, to me, are really like love Nietzsche are not necessarily people at the graduate level, but you have undergrads who basically have had enough after 4 years and they check out and they're going to go be a barista or whatever, but they'll quote Nietzsche as they sling shots at espresso or something.
Well, and his writing style lends itself to that because so many of his works are aphoristic, right? They're numbered either paragraphs or sentences, and it's not always clear how they fit together.
Right.
It doesn't say things like, what I'm trying to say is this.
Right.
Let me be clear. And,
right.
And so it lends itself to this cherry picking and things like that.
Now, well, that sounds like some of Jesus, though, too. I mean,
very much.
I mean, if you read the Sermon on the Mount, I mean, you know, you can tell who the people that love the Sermon on the Mount are, because there does seem to be this tension between, it just seems like in the history of church history, for example, historical theology, those who emphasize the Sermon on the Mount
mm-hmm.
have to do so to some extent at the expense of other things in Scripture.
Well,
yeah,
I wonder about that. I have to think about that.
It is just an odd sermon, and there's so many things. Jesus doesn't just stop and say, look, I know this is weird. Maybe it's not clear. Let me just clearly tell you what I meant by that.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you see Jesus doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe the only place we see that is when he occasionally explains a parable to the disciples.
Yes.
And so there's a fact.
But Jesus didn't have a sister that we know about who went through his notes, you know, and then said, you know, hey, put this in there. Make sure you get this in there next to Revelation.
Have you seen the Chosen at all, this TV show?
Yes.
Have not. I've heard about it. Okay.
There's a great scene where Jesus is working out the Sermon on the Mount and Matthew's taking notes. And it's just really fun. I think they do a nice job on that.
It is. Excellent production. Yeah.
He was a tax collector, so it would make sense that he would have something to write with and maybe think to jot things down that maybe other people didn't jot down at that moment.
Great possibly. Character development. The other thing about, so this guy Pennington, who just wrote on Jesus as philosopher, his previous book, he's actually a New Testament guy, was called something like the Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing. It's really excellent work. And he has a whole chapter on the word blessed and ties this to flourishing and then another chapter on the word perfect. You shall be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And he argues that we mostly misread that. It's not perfection like zero flaws. It's more complete. It's the same word Jesus uses on the cross. It is finished. Right? It is complete.
Yes. Yeah. Well.
And he does. It's really a great study.
Hmm.
On the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, you know, Jesus has a vision for human flourishing, and in relation to God, in relation to one another, and that this is the kind of thing I want to put in contrast with Nietzsche's vision for human flourishing, which I'm still trying to figure out what it is. I mean, if you read Nietzsche very quickly, you're going to get stuff like, well, it's all about power and things like this. I want to be careful and make sure I have it as charitable a read as possible.
Yes. Have you read Use and Abuse of History?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was required for my PhD program. Published. So,
yeah.
What's up?
I've read everything Nietzsche published twice.
Oh, really? Okay. Wow.
Notes. I know.
You're
very
serious.
Deep. Yeah.
Could you argue that, I mean, Nietzsche is really about, in terms of flourishing, it's an unbridled individualism.
Yes, I think you can argue that. I mean, because it's very clear. First on, let's talk about individualism. Nietzsche is in no way an egalitarian.
Right.
He's not trying to think, how can we throw the doors wide open for everyone to enter the best life. Early on, he was super influenced by both Schopenhauer and Wagner, the composer, and from them, he got this notion that the whole point of culture is to produce a few geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
And the geniuses are artistic geniuses, but only a few. And the artistic part of that kind of not fell by the wayside, but it receded in importance, and the geniuses became what we call the Overman or the Superman, the Übermensch, mm-hmm. which is a person who is unbridled. This is the other word you used, in the completely free from the confines of any external standard that's imposed. The Übermensch makes his own values, doesn't just rebel against other values, but makes his own values. And that's the goal, but not many people can actually do that.
Hmm.
I think Nietzsche thought he was a transitional person. Hmm. His work was he was John the Baptist in a sense. Hmm. His work was to make the road straight for the Übermensch to be a possibility.
Oh, wow.
And I'm not sure he ever, now I could be wrong about this, he ever took that title on himself.
Okay.
Right. Übermensch. Now, by the end of his
did that come, the Isaiah 40 quote that you just did? For those who know the Bible, the allusions and echoes, the Isaiah 40 quote is in the Gospels as a description of John the Baptist.
Yes.
And that's Isaiah 40, 1-3 or something like that, somewhere around there. But
I believe so you. I'm impressed.
You're depressed? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Oppressed.
Oppressed, right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a...
I'm not sure if he applied that to himself that way, but
we had Dave Horner on.
That's what he told me.
Yeah. Yeah. And he mentioned, he shared an anecdote from CU Boulder from a Nietzsche professor that he took mm-hmm. there. And that Nietzsche professor said that he lamented how biblically illiterate his students were at Boulder, mm-hmm. except for Dave. Dave understood Nietzsche because Nietzsche was steeped in these biblical allusions and echoes.
And he used all the time.
Okay. Yeah. Did he ever use that of himself, John the Baptist?
I don't remember. So I don't want to say no, but gotcha. No passage sticks out to me.
Because that rolled off your tongue as if, yeah. I was like, well, did you come up with that? Or are you channeling Nietzsche?
Well, I don't know. Because if I did, then it'll make me feel smart.
That was pretty good. That was pretty good. Yeah.
So he was not egalitarian. Unbridled individualism. The unbridled is throwing off all of the remnants of traditional morality, the Platonic vision of what a human person has to be, the Christian story. There's a great passage in the Gay Science where he says, it's in 108, the section 108. I won't get it word for word, but that's okay because it's just a translation anyway. but it's like he says...
We want the original German.
Yeah, exactly. After Buddha had died, for centuries they showed a cave where his shadow could be seen. It was a gruesome shadow. Then he says, God is dead, but his shadow remains, and now we must defeat the shadow of God. And I think that is kind of like you could employ that imagery as a picture of Nietzsche's sense of what he was trying to do, defeat the shadow of God. And the shadow of God is in that morality is something we submit to, that we're supposed to hate this earth because our home is really in the next earth. And even in the way we approach science and truth, if we think, look, the most important thing is the pursuit of truth, and truth is always outside of our bounds, that is part of the shadow of God for him. And
what did he mean by God is dead?
Technically, he meant that it's impossible to take God seriously. He doesn't really mean that there was a God and, you know, he had a stroke and died or something like that.
Yeah.
But the concept of God is over and done with. Now, the famous passage on this is also Gay Science 125. It's the parable of the madman, the madman that stumbles into the marketplace. And that is my favorite piece of philosophical writing of all. I just think
you mean if so from all of Nietzsche or from everywhere, all of philosophy, really?
Yes.
Where is it again? 125.
125 in the Gay Science.
Okay.
And what's interesting about that is we tend to read Nietzsche's Death of God as an indictment against believers, but that passage is mostly an indictment against atheists.
Really? Wow.
Because the atheists in the marketplace are the ones that ridicule the madman. And his point, which is subtext, is the rejection of God changes everything about everything. Yet you atheists think you can reject God and life goes on as before. You can be generous. You can be kind. You can have, you know, feel like your life is going the way it should. You can have your morality, you know, so, and I think his assessment is fairly accurate. People think, okay, we got all this reality and we can just take God out of it, toss it, and it doesn't change anything. But he's saying, look, if God is dead, then there is no up or down. There is no centering of the universe. There is no, and he doesn't explicitly say this in the passage, but what he's getting at is there's no human nature. Right. There's no way to be except what you choose yourself. Yeah. So this kind of passage really flows into Sartre's existentialism, where he says, look, there is no human nature because there's no God. Therefore, everybody chooses his or her own nature. And Nietzsche saw that pretty dramatically.
I think we see this a lot. At least I have a sense that this is a... In my classes, you know, I have students who cannot articulate why murder is wrong. Or any kind of basic or more fundamental moral moral principle or position. In addition to that, I think I do remember there was an article that was written, or maybe it was a conference. I forget his name, but he basically came out and lambasted atheists for borrowing the Judeo-Christian moral framework.
Yeah.
Like you said, just pulling God out and then just, but living life as if the Judeo-Christian moral framework was still true.
Right.
And he basically said, you need to go and get your own moral code, because borrowing from the Judeo-Christian tradition is just an inconsistency on your part.
Can you give an example of what you mean by borrowing from the Judeo-Christian tradition? Just to give people a sense of how this concretely applies. Like, what's a specific example of borrowing from the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Well, I think it's when they implicitly operate under something like the latter six of the Ten Commandments, right? They implicitly act as if stealing, right, is wrong, that murder is wrong. Maybe not covetousness so much, but the latter six,
or adultery for that matter.
Yeah. Adultery. Yeah. Right. So it seems like some of those basic, you know, moral tenets are things that are retained. But yet, you know, there's this notion of, well, God doesn't exist, but I'm still going to operate as if these things are true.
Well, and I think one place you can see it is people are utterly convinced of the universality of human dignity or inviolability. You know, we call it universal human rights, you know, which slides into kind of the political aspect of it. But it's based on the fact that all human beings are intrinsically valuable or something like that. And on atheism, you can press, where in the world does that come from?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually, and some secular thinkers are beginning to realize that that's the shadow of God, right? That's a Christian contribution to our moral the furniture of our minds, so to speak.
So how does, if God is dead, that doesn't, he means just atheism is true, right? That's kind of,
yes.
That's a sloppy way. My way is a sloppy way of just,
well, it's really,
actually it's not really sloppy. It's just clear, but
yeah. Atheism is true. And what does that mean?
Okay.
This is why the phrase God is dead has so much rhetorical power.
Yeah.
It's not just, hey, I'm an atheist. Like, you know, I'm a Red Sox fan.
For us. Yeah. What does that mean for, okay. I got you. Mm-hmm. So it means that we don't believe God exists. Mm-hmm. And it's not really an invitation to consider whether that's true or not, I don't mean whether it's true that you don't believe. I mean,
whether
the proposition that you believe is, you don't believe is true. Yeah. Whether atheism is true. And you have the implication of God in Western Europe and culture, mm-hmm. like, you know, I guess you'd call it Christendom.
Right.
Maybe what used to be the Holy Roman Empire, I believe, is where he lived. Right. Yeah. Am I getting my history right? Yeah.
Close enough.
Germanic
history.
I know Germany was there, and it was like the Holy Roman Empire was Germany for a while, and that's why they call the Kaiser the Caesar and the Pope. I mean, of course the Protestant Reformation occurred there as well, and you have disagreements among Christians, but you still had this in Europe. You had, what happened was there was a deep cultural significance of Christianity. Didn't always make sense. People fought about it. They actually fought about it and argued about it. And so Nietzsche at the end of the 1800s is noticing that a lot of people are atheists, but they haven't caught up to what that really means.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And so at the end of this madman parable in Gay Science 125, the madman stumbles into churches and sings a Requiem Aeternum Deo, Requiem for the Eternal God, a funeral song. And as he's brought out and called to account, he says, "What are these churches but the tombs of God?" And I think the ironic point that's dropped at the end is, the people who claim to believe in God really live as if he's dead. And the people who claim there is no God live as if he's alive. And so there's a little bit of indictment on the powerlessness of Christianity at the very end of the story. Of irony.
Yes.
And I'm never sure I'm using the word irony properly. So you feel free to edit that if you discover I'm not.
I'm mainly concerned that when you say it, you spell it correctly as you're saying it. That's my main concern.
Well, that would be hard too.
But, well, okay. So Jesus, by contrast, is in a situation where Judaism has, let's just not talk about Greco-Roman stuff. Although as the kids say now, technically, as if that, adds anything to what I'm about to say, but they were under the, that part of the Roman Empire, obviously sure. was part of the Roman Empire. So, but that area had been steeped in a Jewish tradition mm-hmm. that went back centuries, millennia. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is a figure that takes that for granted and mm-hmm. says, no, we don't want to change that. That's true. Mm-hmm. But there's a new significance coming in here. God's doing something different through me mm-hmm. and you need to pay attention. So that's yeah. very, it's a contrast with Nietzsche, but there's some similarity in the sense that there's a shared tradition that people just take for granted.
Yes. And the tradition, from what I understand, which, you know, I haven't done my background research on this part of it yet, and I'm not a New Testament guy, but what the period they call
by not a New Testament guy, you mean you're not a scholar, right?
I'm not a scholar, right?
Okay. You don't mean that you don't, you just discount the New Testament.
Right? Oh, no. I like the New Testament.
Okay. That's just everybody. That's scholarly talk for, yeah. I don't read it in Greek with no dictionary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for the clarification.
I just saved your job there.
I know. I was just going to say, I could have gotten fired if that was misinterpreted. The period in which Jesus lived is often called Second Temple Judaism, which I just discovered because I had a discussion with somebody about when it began, and goes back to the return from exile of people like Ezra, and where there's a reconstituting of the nation of Israel, Jewish life, and what emerges there is these different kinds of sects within Judaism. All the major players we see in the Gospels developed in this period, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes. Now, the Essenes aren't very dominant in the Gospels, but there's some, from what I understand, you know, there's some background stuff. They lurk in the shadows because they lived in the caves. And it seems like what Jesus came in a sense to overthrow was the distortions that came mostly from the Pharisees and in part from the Sadducees. And so there is a little iconoclasm to his ministry, which is parallel to the iconoclasm we find in Nietzsche, right? Something needs to be overthrown.
Yes. That's good. I'm glad you added that. Yes.
Yeah. Something needs to be rehabilitated. Right. And those are the kinds of questions that are helpful to identify someone's mission or worldview. It's like, what do they think needs to be overthrown? What do they think needs to be rehabilitated? Another way to get yes. close to it is, what is it that's oppressing people, and what is it that brings liberation?
And I think I see where you're going with that.
These are general questions that are really helpful. I used to tell my kids, when you watch a movie, always ask the question, who gets converted in the movie?
Oh, wow.
Someone always gets converted.
There's like an arc, a character arc. Yeah.
And in Disney movies, it's always the parents get converted. It's never the kids. Interesting that, you know, you think Mary Poppins is, of course, all about Mr. Banks. It's not about Mary Poppins or the kids. It's about his conversion. And it's a great story. It's one of my favorite movies. But so it's helpful to have these kinds of questions that's
the deepest thing you've said all.
I know.
Morning.
Miss Mary Poppins.
The stuff you said about Disney is the deepest stuff.
It is.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Now, it might not literally be true that every film has a conversion, but many do. Somebody starts with one perspective or worldview or practice and then winds up with another.
Well, yeah, that's what makes it interesting to watch. I mean, if it was just you filming, you go about your day. Here I am brushing my teeth. The words go up, directed by, produced by, you know, and then it's you brushing your teeth and we're all waiting. What's going to happen? What's the point of this? And you're eating your breakfast and you're having your coffee and going to the bathroom. Got to make sure we get that in there. Don't edit anything out. And then you're driving to work. Every second we have that filmed. And then it's just like after 2 hours, then the credits go up. Well, no one would say that that was a very good film because they would say nothing happened, even though actually a bunch of stuff happened.
Yeah.
But when we say nothing happened, we typically mean there was no point to it. And so the arc is the point, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. All right.
So for Nietzsche, what liberates is breaking out of the traditional moral framework. Hmm. And what oppresses is these kinds of things, right? Morality, religion, they all oppress in the same way. The will to truth, which means making truth the most important thing. And of course, Jesus has an entirely different thing. He says, the truth sets you free. And what oppresses is rebellion against God. Everyone who sins is a slave. And so this is really a place where their diagnostics come into conflict with each other. But everybody has a story about what is it that oppresses and what is it that liberates.
Yeah. So for Jesus, what's the answer to that question?
Well, truth liberates. Right now, what does he mean by that? It's a pithy little sentence, and it's engraved on libraries all over the West.
Yeah, the including Yale, I think.
Yes, I think. Is it on there? It's probably, I mean,
it's on Harvard, I know that.
30 libraries. I'm sure it's on one of them. It's interesting that this is a tangent. The main library at Yale is the Sterling Memorial Library. And it was built in the 30s to resemble a chapel. But the altar, so to speak, it's all a chapel to learning. It's not a chapel to God. Mm-hmm. And the stained glass on the side are all great pictures of scientific discovery and stuff like that. And I mean, it's a beautiful building. So when Jesus says the truth will set you free, there's a lot going on there. He's not using the word truth in its some semantic sense, in the way a philosopher will say a sentence is true if what it says about reality matches reality, right? You know, and it's not about theories of truth. Now, some of this stuff might be in the background, but truth liberates us because a flourishing life has to be reality centered, right? So we have to have a proper diagnosis of what is good, what is beautiful, what is worth pursuing, and what is not worth pursuing, mm-hmm. if we're going to flourish. And so it's that reality centeredness that's part of it. And of course, Jesus goes on to say a few chapters later that he is the truth.
Yeah.
And so he's obviously using the term in this broad sense.
Wow.
You know, he is the truth in that he's the authoritative, decisive revelation of God.
Yes.
And as fully human and fully God, his divine nature is the truth that he is the most foundational reality.
Hmm.
Everything that comes into being through him and for him. So he's kind of the center of reality. And of course, truth is all about reality.
Right.
So
Nietzsche never says anything like that, right?
No, he doesn't. His, for lack of a better word, his beef with truth. Now, one reading of Nietzsche is that he's a postmodernist.
Okay.
And that he rejects all.
That's a $10 word. We're going to need some kind of definition of that.
Oh, okay. Well, it's very hard.
Hence the term. There's modernism, and then it's after that.
it's after modernism. But yeah. You know, when people used to write on postmodernism in the 90s, Christians, they would always describe modernism, and they would always get it horribly confused. And then they would describe postmodernism, and I would say half of what you just said is part of modernism. So, to be honest, I'm not sure postmodernism is a thing.
Okay.
I think it's kind of the working out of certain kinds of working out of modernism. Now, it's okay to use the term.
Sure.
And
what do you mean by modernism then? Because maybe that will help.
Modernism is a vague term that gestures at the intellectual, at least in philosophy, the intellectual framework from Descartes into the 20th century.
And Descartes was 1500s?
1596 to 1650.
Okay.
And he started
in France.
In France. He was in France. And at the same time, modern science was developing. He was a contemporary of Galileo. And so it wasn't just a philosophical movement. It's philosophy, science. It's actually a result of the Reformation. The breaking up of the church began to break up the unified sense of political structures, and this is more your field than mine, by a long shot, and the assumptions about life. Epistemology became really important because you had to justify various positions that you would hold. And so there's all this thread that can be called modernism. It's sometimes connected with the triumph of reason, and then the postmodern response is going to be something like the undermining of the value and efficacy of reason. But that's not entirely fair, because Romanticism, which started in the late 18th century into the beginning of the 19th century, was already doing this.
Okay. What do you mean by Romanticism?
Another you're picking me at places that I can only gesture. Romanticism was a movement that involved,
has nothing to do with Days of Our Lives, right? On,
yes, exactly.
On TV. Okay. Hope and Roman.
A lot of literary people, theologians, some philosophers, and it was a sense that it was a reaction to rationalism, or the high value that reason is the only thing. Mm-hmm. And
emotions,
in short,
matter too, something like
emotions
that.
Emotions matter. To be human is more than to be rational.
Okay. Right?
And so it put a high view on aesthetic experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you want an interesting picture of Romanticism, you read Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility. There are two sisters. There's Eleanor and Marianne. Marianne's the romantic. Eleanor is kind of super grounded, so much so that she has trouble really engaging her, you know, she wants to master her disappointments and exert control over them in the line of duty.
Okay.
And Marianne is like, no, my feelings are the only things that matter, kind of thing. It's a simplified version, but Jane Austen was a critic of Romanticism.
Oh, she was critical. Okay.
Yeah. And so
was she, Eleanor, a rationalist, Jane Austen?
Oh, geez.
Or a modernist? If people are struggling with these terms.
She was a fairly traditional, I think, modernist.
She wasn't interested in science, though, right? It's not like
it's not that. From her works, you don't get a lot of that. But
she's not reading Descartes and then saying, I want to write a novel now.
She read Hume.
Oh, did she? Much. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
History of England.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yale has a copy with all of our notes in it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And okay. I think she was more a trickle-down modernist in the sense that the proper life to live is one where duty matters and you do what's right.
And trickle-down Austinomics?
What's that?
Trickle-down Austinomics.
Yeah, I think that's great.
It's a stupid comment, but
yeah, no, actually, I like it.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks.
One of my boys wrote a screenplay called Ostentatious about a guy trying to make a Jane Austen film to impress a girl. And so anyway, so romanticism is aesthetic, yes. Experience becomes central.
Okay.
And that gets taken up in different ways. And it influenced Nietzsche because Wagner was part of this. And in the end, they were kind of critical of the romantic movement, but they kept some of the centrality of aesthetics. So intellectual history is much more complicated than the labels modernism and postmodernism. Yeah. And we should expect that. They can be helpful labels. Normally, when people want to read Nietzsche in a postmodern way, they think he has rejected any kind of truth. And of course, it sounds like he does this in many places. But if you sift through a little bit, he thinks what he's saying is true. Mm. He thinks it's true there's no God. You think it's true that there's a better way to live, better not morally, but for human flourishing.
Does he ever say, this is why I think that? Here's what happened. I had these thoughts and I was like, therefore, God does not exist. Does he ever, or does he just assume it and just expect you to kind of, okay.
That there's no God.
So he's kind of like one of these preachers in an anti-intellectual church that just say, yeah, believe it, and or we'll just assume you believe it, and then
I hesitate to make that comparison.
You think he's not anti-intellectual?
No, not at all. I mean,
so how can he just assume it without saying why? Because he's got to think there's people that would disagree with this, right?
Yes.
I mean, he's not, is he? Well, I don't mean that he cares. I mean that he knows about that, and they would maybe read his stuff. And isn't he concerned about?
No. He in many places. In fact, I can't remember which book of his had a subtitle. He in many places he said, "I'm not writing for people alive today. I'm writing for people who will come after, because people alive today can't get it." And he's talking about the philosopher of the future and so he's and given that there's no God, he's
okay. He's making a prediction. He's saying, I'm way ahead of you guys.
Yeah. And of course he turned out to be right, because his books barely sold. Even my book sold more than Nietzsche in his lifetime, which is hard to believe, right? As few as mine that sell. And you know, it wasn't really until starting in World War I that he began to circulate. I mean, the German nation gave soldiers Thus Spoke Zarathustra and the New Testament when they went off to war in World War I. And
wow, that's confusing.
I know if it went to everybody.
Which one do you want me to?
Yeah, which one should I read first?
So that's an interesting starting point for your project. Is there it is, Nietzsche versus Jesus, right there in the hands of the German, the German soldier. Yeah,
yeah.
How many people died in World War I, and they were on the wrong side of that? I think.
It's hard to tell.
I mean, I'm a partisan of
my best analysis of World War I comes from a Bob Dylan song called With God on Our Side.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to know, huh?
The First World War, it came and it went. The reason for fighting, I never could get.
Well, it would be interesting if that's really true, that anecdote that you said, I have no reason to believe it's not true, that the Kaiser would put two books in the hands of the German soldier. It would be interesting to ask, okay, what did the king put in the hands of the British soldier?
Right, right.
What was it, just the New Testament? Or right. I know when I went to boot camp, they had copies of the New Testament available to anybody who wanted them, mm-hmm. and for free, paid for by, I don't know. I mean, but it was on government property.
Right? Yeah.
And I don't know if the government paid for it. I would assume maybe they did because they had chaplains. But we had a base chapel.
Yeah, of course.
There was a little New Testament. I think I still have it somewhere. It's got Psalms and Proverbs in it.
Right.
And there was, I'm just trying to imagine getting into boot camp and we have New Testament available for you. And, we also have Friedrich Nietzsche, his complete writings, and Charles Darwin or something. I mean, it would just be weird. So anyway, thought I would point that out.
No, that's good. I made a note of it. I don't want to forget that.
Okay, I get 10%.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll get a footnote. You won't get 10% of the footnotes. They're going to be too many footnotes.
I'll take it.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it's only a dime.
Can you explain, when it gets back to this notion of truth, right? Mm-hmm. That for Jesus, the truth shall set you free. Mm-hmm. But Nietzsche, doesn't he say that the truth is a necessary error?
Yes.
And ultimately, you know, if he's in the wake of Kant, I mean, he's not offering an alternative to theism. Mm-hmm. He's basically saying, isn't he, that there's no reality to be gotten at, period. Right? There's nothing else. So everything else is just, this is where the individualism comes from. There's nothing to conform to. There's nothing to follow. There's nothing to necessarily approve of as truth. There's what we have is labeled truth is just a pragmatic or a convenient or a necessary error that we have to adopt to get on with living.
Yeah, I think so. Now, I want to make a distinction on Nietzsche's mm-hmm. behalf. And this is how I read him, following like a couple of people. Well, actually, not a few people. We got to make a distinction between what we sometimes call capital T truth and small t truth. Mm-hmm. So Nietzsche is going to say, of course, you look both ways before you cross the street because you might get hit by a car. There is a reality there. Right. And the reality is what we experience every day. So there is, he's not denying everyday truths, but he is denying capital T truths. And there are two ways in what you just said that he's very conscious of. And one is the Kantian picture, which he picks up mostly from Schopenhauer, of there's a world as it is in itself, independent of the human contribution. Mm-hmm. And we can never get to that world. That's Kant's story, but it impinges on us in some way. Nietzsche said, there is no such world. And as soon as we give that up, we're going to be better off. All there is the world we experience. And then this gets translated into his critique of some elements of the scientific picture, although he read a great deal in the biological sciences of the 19th century and things like this. But the notion that the scientist has to keep digging and digging and digging for truth, and it's always outside of his reach, he calls that the will to truth. Mm-hmm. And it's a capital, we would say capital T truths, right? The final story about the galaxy, we're gonna reach it. He says, no, you never reach. There is no final story.
Right.
And he rejects that. But when it comes to things like, is God real? No. Are human beings free or determined? by the end of his writing in Beyond Good and Evil, he says that's a really misformed question. Human beings aren't free, not because of determinism, because determinism is something we interpret and put on the world. So we reject determinism, but we also reject freedom because the whole concept of a self is just like causation, something we interpret and put on the world.
Right.
What we really have is an amalgam of drives. There isn't like one self that wills to do something. One drive within us becomes dominant. And so the question, are human beings free, actually makes no sense.
Right.
And so he believes in the truth of well-established deliverances of science. Mm-hmm. We are just like other animals. We differ in degree, not in kind. And that becomes a lever to reject kind of the worship of science or the ethical framework, that, you know, the moral or the religious framework. So yeah, what you're saying is right. He thinks the Kantian picture is, it's one of the things that has to be overcome. Just like, I mean, there's a great passage in Twilight of the Idols called How the True World Became a Fable. And the true world is in quotes. And he starts with Plato. There's like six things. You know, Plato, the true world is the world of forms. And you could reach it by turning against your passions and contemplating. Second, Christianity, you have to hate this world to achieve the true world. Third is Kant. Right. There's a world that's there, but it's not even reachable anymore.
Right.
And then the last three stages are the rejection of these worlds, where he says, then positivism comes. He went through a positivistic period. And he said, like, if Kant is right, what does it matter? How can an unreachable world impose obligations on us? Mm-hmm. Not just moral obligations, but epistemic obligations. And then the fifth stage is, so we reject the true world. You know, that's the world behind appearance. And then the last stage is, once you reject the true world, the illusory world is gone as well, because to call a world illusion only makes sense against the true world.
Sure.
And what world is left is just the world of experience.
Right.
I mean, he reads almost like David Hume in some of these parts. Mm-hmm. And I've poked around a bit, and he probably never read Hume's treatise or Inquiry. He had a copy of the Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion in German translation, of course, and may have read that. And he attended some lectures in the history of philosophy that talked about Hume, but he didn't really have a firsthand knowledge. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
yeah.
So what you're saying is exactly right. It's like,
would you say that Hume was an atheist, or what was his belief about God?
I think it's very murky. I mean, Charles Taylor cites something, and I can't remember what he cited. I was just reading this, where Hume is at a dinner party and he says, "Yeah, there are no atheists here." And by the end of the dialogues, he gives the design argument some credence. It's just impossible to believe that this happened by accident. Mm-hmm. And he certainly wasn't a practicing religious person.
I mean, he seems to suggest that a design argument that would be successful would be one if we weren't talking about a transcendent, omnipotent, and omniscient being.
Yes.
But if you dial it down and multiply, you know, then we have a design argument that potentially can work. Like if we were talking about Mount Olympus, for example,
right?
Perhaps he would say that Mount Olympus could bring a universe like ours into existence.
Yeah. Yeah. All you need is, you know, sufficient power. And of course he's very sarcastic. Right. He says the world looks like it was run by a pretty bad committee.
So what's the design argument, just so people can track with that? I know we're assuming the average philosopher probably will be able to follow this pretty well, but for someone who's just kind of really curious but maybe doesn't have a background in philosophy or can't remember what that is, what would you say it is? Well, the design kind of argument us, it's the design argument is a conclusion, right, that says
it's a
God exists. Okay,
it starts with a hunch, said that the things we see in the world have features that lead us to believe they had to be designed. So the features might be a certain kind of complexity or structure related to purpose. And early on at Hume's time, people would talk about the structure of the human eye and the wing of a bird and these kinds of things. After Darwin's time, you get a plausible story for how these things could appear to be designed, even if they're not. And so biological things lose their traction as a foundation for the design argument. So the cosmologists launched another.
Of course, at that time, he didn't know anything about irreducible complexity, and he didn't know anything about the cellular level and how complex.
Well, Darwin certainly didn't. And
DNA.
Right. The intelligent design people are going to say things like there still are marks of design in the biological world, like you're talking about. And a mark of design is irreducible complexity, which means it's not just complex, but it's the kind of complexity that it doesn't seem like could develop step by step, because you need the whole complexity to get any function. And Michael Behe's analogy is with a mousetrap. You need all the pieces to get a functioning mousetrap. If you just had one piece, it wouldn't function. So there would be nothing of survival value in a half-constructed mousetrap. I mean, it's just an analogy. But
The eye is very complex.
Oh, very complex.
When you hear people at a popular level, even really smart people at a popular level, describe the purpose of in evolution. Like they use the word purpose, or they use purpose language, which of course is the design language.
Yes.
They'll say the purpose of the eye is so that we can see the tiger. I think I'm almost quoting verbatim something on YouTube. Purpose of an eye is to see so we can see the tiger. Mm-hmm. And so that it has a survival function that way. Mm-hmm. But of course, the eye has to be already working.
Right.
For it to and that imply for that organism to I don't know how he outruns the tiger. I missed that part, but but I mean, and not to say nothing of the brain and how it has to be linked up with the brain in the right way. And so that's very complicated.
It is very complicated. Now, I think that if you're an atheistic Darwinist, you can appeal to teleology. Right, it's clear that the heart has a function in the whole system. It plays a role in the system, and you don't need to.
So you say play a role is what you mean, yeah?
Yeah, you don't need to say that role had to be given by a mind.
Right.
See, when we use the word purpose, sometimes we're thinking of an idea in the mind of someone that executes it in, the world or something. But the heart has a purpose in the function, in the proper functioning of the human body. And so I don't think we can jump on people for importing teleological language. And there's a lot of work that's been done on this recently in the philosophy of biology that you have to have teleology to do biology. Doesn't
that turn the teleology idea upside down, though? Because when you say proper function,
That's
a teleological. That relativizes the word proper, right? To whatever you desire. We value, right? We value, guess, what would you say? Long life, which would imply the heart needs to function, in a way that keeps the organism not only alive, but with what we call positive mental states and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But then the further question is, but is that really valuable? Is that really the design of people? Like in terms of, or is there no design of people?
Yeah.
And so I think what you mean by that is that there's a way of speaking linguistically about function and design that just means the role that something plays in a context somehow. Is that right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Okay. There are two separate questions. So we can look at a plant. Even I can look at a plant and for the most part, assess whether it's flourishing or not. And the photosynthesis occurring in the leaves has part of the function to create complex sugars out of minerals, oxygen, with light energy and all this stuff, and for the functioning of the plant. And there's kind of objective flourishing or not. It's not just preference. It's not just that.
I missed the part. How is it objective?
Because the plant that's withered is objectively not flourishing. It's biologically, it's not an aesthetic statement that I don't like.
It's withered. Incapable of reproduction. Is that what we mean?
Yeah. It's less able to fulfill its biological functions, so to speak. And this is why teleology can't be eliminated. But it's a whole different question about whether plants should flourish, right? That's stepping outside of the functioning of an individual plant and importing a kind of teleology to the whole system, which is what you're talking about.
Okay.
I see what you're saying. Why is it a good thing that plants flourish?
Well, yeah. And do you mean by flourishing the ability to reproduce?
Well, that's going to be part of it, right? The ability to grow well, to produce.
Right.
Complex sugars. I don't know what plants do, right? They sit around and think about us, right.
I mean, I'm tracking with you. I see what you're saying. I think what I would say is, if I would just wonder if you go that route. First of all, you can ask: is reproduction good or bad? I mean, that's still a further question. But secondly, it's there's all sorts of individual organisms that either don't reproduce or have already, and they can't anymore. But what it seems like they would still be flourishing. Wonder if you can reduce it to these biological concepts of reproduction, because when people say survival of the fittest, you know, I always tell my students, what you mean is that survive long enough to reproduce. And that's what you mean. That's what survival of the fittest means.
Right. But when I say flourishing for a plant, I'm not reducing it to reproduction. I'm reducing it to, or I'm also identifying the inner workings of the plant parts, you know, the and this kind of thing, which is objective. But as soon as you ask the question, is it a good thing to reproduce, then you're taking an external
advantage.
And I'm trying to stay internally.
Gotcha.
We can have teleology, an internal teleology, without having an external purpose.
So we're talking about as if there's a design plan, even if we haven't decided if there is a design plan.
Yeah. Because
the design plan can only be there if there's a designer, right?
Right.
Okay.
If complex functioning can emerge without a designer, then we don't need a designer to explain the complex functioning. Right. Now that's a tautology, the way I say it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with granting that. And you say, look, if the Darwinian story is true, then this stuff happens. As soon as you ask an external question about the value of it or something like that, then you're moving into something that the internal story has no resources to answer. This gets complicated.
We're barely scratching the surface. Do you think, in terms of environmental ethics, for example,
right,
you have the concept of pollution? And that's interesting to me because pollution seems to imply that there's something the way it shouldn't be.
Right.
As so, for example, you're walking on the beach. Let's say it's a natural beach. The sand is there mm-hmm. naturally. What I mean by naturally is it wasn't put there by humans. It got there
right.
by natural processes that were not human. But now what I'm doing mm-hmm. is I'm taking human beings out. I'm just assuming this is maybe it'd be interesting to see what Nietzsche would say about this, because mm-hmm. it seems like a very biblical thing to exclude human activity from the natural. That sounds like Genesis to me, where God creates the yeah. heavens and the earth. People mm-hmm. are over here. They're very good, but they're created in the image of God. People mm-hmm. are responsible for creation. They're uniquely suited to care for it and tend the garden and all that. And so if I'm walking on the beach and I see a Snicker wrapper, I don't think, oh, that's there naturally. That right. is just a long story of evolution mm-hmm. and chemical evolution, physical processes, which includes human beings. After all, we're just part of the natural world. And what do you know, some natural human just threw that there, and how interesting that is. And I'm looking at a seagull pecking at the the chocolate, you know, bits on the Snickers, and that's natural too, and it's all natural all the way down. But how do you make sense of the concept of pollution? Or
see, I think you're putting your finger on something really, really insightful here. So Nietzsche wants to, and not Nietzsche alone, but human beings are just part of the natural world. Okay. And anyone who moves in this direction is going to have a problem with environmental ethics, I think. Why are human beings responsible for the rest of the natural world? The lion is not responsible for the animals it eats, right? And so if you bring humans into the natural, then anything we do is part of the natural world. And the concept of pollution might lose its, ontological status or its reality, and it becomes much more of an aesthetic. We have an aesthetic aversion to Snicker wrappers on a pristine beach. It's hard to say it shouldn't be that way. And I love the phrase you use there, because this gets into our concept of good and bad and good and evil. Is something is bad or evil is if it shouldn't be this way. Something is good if it should be this way, yeah. which does imply this external teleology, I think. But if we are responsible for the environment in some sense, or we have some degree of responsibility for our impact of the environment, then we stand outside it to some degree. Now, the one place you might be able to split the difference is if you're some kind of utilitarian. And if you can justify utilitarianism on these grounds, which I have no idea, you could say, look, there's a good in limiting pollution because on balance, it produces more pain than pleasure, counting each person the same. So it's better to remove pollution. So it could be that the utilitarian, Peter Singer's a utilitarian, is kind of the only step forward if we want to be naturalists about human persons. Now, there are all kinds of other problems that might emerge, like human freedom. If I'm determined, then utilitarianism is not helpful because I can't choose, and this kind of thing. So I think you're bringing up something really important.
Thank you. I was going to say,
you think Nietzsche would reject big bucks, but even utilitarianism here? I mean, it's
yeah, he hated utilitarianism.
It's all species, right?
Who tell us why?
System is a species. What's that? Yeah.
Tell us why. Why did he reject utilitarianism?
Well, it's
what is it? Oh, did you say egalitarianism or utilitarianism?
No, utilitarianism is egalitarian, right? You count each person the same. And he thinks it has a naive view of human psychology. He calls these people the English psychologists. And I'm pretty sure he's picking at people like Bentham and Mill. And although I'm not as sure about Mill, because I can't remember the dates of Mill. It probably was. Where responsibility and rightness is derived this way. I think he just thought it was shallow and he had no patience for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Did the utilitarians read Nietzsche, do you think?
Well, not,
I mean, it was
the
before
early
he, yeah, he was before yeah. he was famous, but
no.
Sidgwick, for example, Sidgwick, he was a famous.
Oh, Sidgwick was a little later. I forget Sidgwick's dates. I don't know if Sidgwick
would. He would have known Nietzsche, right?
He probably would have.
And he was a massive fan.
I was thinking of Bentham, who's.
Well, yeah, that would be too early.
Too early, and Mill's probably too early.
Well, Greg, I don't want to get you off topic, but I was curious, what was it like studying at Syracuse when getting your PhD there? And
yeah, Syracuse.
Who did you study with? Why did you go there and stuff like that?
Well, I applied to schools. I wanted there to be a Christian faculty member because I didn't want to be fighting, the basic questions all the time. And so I applied to Syracuse because there were two. Peter Van Inwagen was there and Bill Alston. And
say his name again for everybody.
Peter Van Inwagen.
Okay.
Who shortly after moved to Notre Dame, he does metaphysics, and then William Alston, okay. Who did
his pen name is William P. Alston or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, that's what he goes by.
But you call him Bill because
I did like after this. I graduated.
Okay,
not before.
Okay, and you said you did study with Peter Van Inwagen.
Well, I had classes with him, and Alston was my dissertation advisor.
That counts.
Yeah.
I would say that counts. Yeah. And, what was it like studying with Van Inwagen? What was it like writing papers for him and stuff?
Well, of course, it scared you to death, right? Because he's considered one of the top living metaphysicians. And,
is he physically imposing? Is there something about his physical demeanor that would scare you to death?
Well, his demeanor. I mean, Van Inwagen had a reputation of being very intense with students. But to be honest, we never saw that. he didn't mind pushing back on you, but he was.
Isn't that the point of a professor? That's great.
Yes. Yeah. He was great fun.
You said he's intense. We had
a Bible study for grad students, and Peter would come every time.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
And Peter and my wife Jeannie got to be pretty close because Jeannie wouldn't put up with his nonsense. all the grad students in this Bible study think everything Peter says is true, and Jeannie would just hit him and say, "Peter, that's not right. Come on, look at the text again." and Peter really liked her, and partly because Peter's wife Lizette is a lot like Jeannie, right? Outgoing, not academic, willing to puncture anybody's bubble, and so yeah, he was great fun. But when we first showed up, it was intimidating because
Did He's you important. Know about him before yeah. you applied? Is that was that one of the reasons?
That was one of the reasons. Yeah.
Okay. And I'd what read was his it, book. Okay, what was it about him that
Well, his first really important book was an essay on free will, which yeah. was published in 1983.
I was forced to read that. I was forced yeah. by David Hunt.
Yes, of course. Well, David's a good philosopher.
That's his deal too.
Yeah,
metaphysics of agency. Yeah,
yeah, he's done that for a long time, and then the same thing with Alston. You know, his reputation was intimidating, and mm-hmm. Alston was a little introverted, okay. And so it took a while to begin to believe that he kind of liked you.
Is that different than Peter Vanenwagen?
Peter's introverted, but he's more social.
Okay.
You know, if you're at a party, you get Peter telling stories about eccentric philosophers and everybody's laughing for hours.
So he'll do that and then he'll crash yeah. later and not talk to anybody for 5 days.
That's probably about right.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Whereas Alston, well, you'll get a few sentences out of him and he'll crash for 5 days.
Yes.
Because it was so yes. much. Okay. So what was it like working with Alston? What was it about him that you drew you to have him on your dissertation?
Well, he was the guy who was doing most of the, I took a seminar with him on the nature of God. And I went into this seminar deciding I'm going to pick my dissertation topic during this class and write my paper on it. And partly I was trying to figure out how do I not waste a lot of time. I mean, I had two young kids by this time. I'm trying to remember if our daughter was born by this time or not.
You trying to think of the time of day or the date?
Time of year when I had the seminar.
Time of which year. Okay, gotcha.
And, but, you know, I thought I can't waste a ton of time here. So I wrote this paper for him, which he liked. And I thought, this is what I'm going to write my dissertation on. So it made sense that he would be my main advisor. He was a great advisor. Mm. He had high standards, very fast to turn things around, but very generous too. He wasn't super picky for the sake of being picky. And I think most of the professors there were like that. You know, sometimes you get people or you hear of people where your dissertation has to change the world. And that's bad, right? You want people to think a dissertation is just to show you can do the research. And most of the people at Syracuse, maybe all of them, but the ones that I heard people talk about were all like that. And so they made it really good to work with them. And
that's awesome.
So yeah, it was a fun time.
I'm jealous.
Yeah,
that's cool. I mean, I was forced to read Alston too, and
yeah,
not like a lot of him, but enough to get a sense of what I think. Adam and I both had to write a précis for Doug Guyvett on Alston's two types of foundationalism or two types of internalism, maybe two types of foundational. Right. And I forget.
Yeah.
I'll have to dig it up, but yeah.
Yeah.
I
he's a dense writer.
Yes. That's what I remember so clearly was how do I summarize this thing? Holy cow. And Doug was very picky about how whether we included everything and did we leave anything out and did we fairly capture what he said? So,
yeah.
And all I remember is he didn't have any pictures in the dang thing. So
I know there were no pictures. So the summer before we had our epistemology seminar, one of my colleagues, one of the grad students, outlined one of the books we were going to use was Bonjour's The Structure of Empirical Knowledge.
Lawrence Bonjour, and he had University of Washington.
Yeah, yeah.
Internalist foundationalist.
Was he a foundationalist?
He was a coherentist. Okay. Sorry for all these weird terms.
Yes.
Hopefully
but
catch on.
But Paul's outline was 40 pages for this book, very detailed. And then he outlined one of Alston's essays, and it was 20 pages. That's how dense his essays are. And
yeah,
but they were great to work.
Wow.
It was a privilege.
Now would you say your dissertation is on epistemology or philosophy of religion, or how would you characterize it?
It's philosophy of religion. I argued for God being outside of time.
Oh.
And based on Alston's paper that God's knowledge is not knowledge in virtue of belief. He has a paper, does God have beliefs?
Yes, I remember that.
And then I argue that if he's right, God has to be atemporal, because the cognitive relation he's articulating can't span time. Right. Mm-hmm. I just summarized 18 months of work in like four sentences.
Wow.
And so that was fun.
From beginning to end, how long did it take you at Syracuse?
Four and a half years.
Well, that sounds pretty fast, but you already have a master's, right, at this time?
I already had a master's, which cut off some of my coursework.
Okay.
So,
and
really fine. Yeah.
Did you have a New England accent when you showed up at Syracuse?
I don't know. I might still have one.
I that's why we had John, frankly, is purely for that.
Yeah, my mom was born and raised in Boston. So my dad used to say that when she would call her sister, her Boston accent would come out.
You remind me so much of a guy I served in the Navy with named John Harwood. And John was from, he would say New England. He grew up in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And so, but every time you talk, you totally remind me of him.
Oh, that's funny.
You sound like him.
Yeah.
So it's great fun to hear you chat and talk. Yeah. So when getting out of Syracuse, when you did, my mentor in high school, Gordon R. Lewis, also went to Syracuse.
Okay. Yes.
That was before Alston went there. I don't know who his advisor was. I wouldn't know the name, but he did his PhD dissertation on St. Augustine.
Right.
But
right.
He would say that it was very cold in the winter and long winters. Is that right?
So yep.
Upstate New York. And then it's been a while since I looked at a map, but I think that's right. And then, but fairly pretty seasons, right?
Yes. Yes. Long winter, beautiful spring, summer, and fall.
Okay. And then he had to type his dissertation on a typewriter. Did you have to do that, or did you have a Ford?
No, processor? I had a computer by the time I was doing it. And
okay.
All right. What years were you
there? 90 to 95.
Okay.
Right. So when I started my master's, I was typing, and we got our first computer about halfway through there.
Were you there perhaps during the summer of 94?
Is this a Brian Adams song? What are you trying to? Oh, sorry. That's summer of 69. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just asking because I went to, I'm from Vermont and the Burlington area. So just across the pond there. But one of my friends and I, when I was a junior in high school, we signed up to go to a basketball camp at Syracuse University.
Oh my gosh.
Under Jim Boeheim.
Yeah.
And so we were there for, I don't know, like a week or two or something like that. And
we lived there then, but we would often travel in the summers because I was still working with crew on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And so we might not have literally been there at the same time, but you know, we were there. Yeah.
Just funny. It just made all these memories come back about being in Syracuse that one summer. So
that's a fun place.
Greg, what would you say the favorite thing that you've written is?
Oh my gosh.
Do you have a favorite?
I think I really like this book, Our Deepest Desires. So far, that's my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, not many people, now people are starting to do this kind of thing. But it's an argument, not that Christianity is true, but that it's good, that we want it to be true. And I think this is the next horizon of cultural engagement.
Okay.
You know, Nietzsche has this great line where he says, what counts against Christianity now is our taste, not our reason. And of course, he's pretty happy about this. But that's the way it is in the West.
Okay.
People just don't want to be Christian.
Yes.
Because they think it's ugly. Right. And so we have a lot of work to do, both theoretically and in terms of how we live it out, to show that, no, actually, this is the best life.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I want to do with the Jesus and Nietzsche, to show that Jesus' vision of life is actually superior.
How would you summarize your book? Do you have an idea of what that would be, the conclusion, or is that still in process?
I want to say, I want to, first of all, kind of, I don't know how I'm going to structure it, but put them side by side, their visions of life, and then talk about why each might strike us as plausible, and then show why Jesus is better, why his vision of life actually captures what we want the most. I mean, my audience is not a Christian.
I
want
to read that. Oh,
right. Okay. I'm hoping now, I'm dreaming actually, to land this with kind of the kind of book that gets into Barnes and Noble and into airport bookstores.
Yeah.
So that's the NPR crowd, I call it.
Okay.
That's the kind of place I want to try to land it.
Sure. Yeah.
Because, you know, I have to be careful how I say this. Even my last book, which InterVarsity Press published and did a great job on, it doesn't get into the hands of non-Christians, but it was written for people who aren't Christians.
Right.
And it's helpful for Christians, but I think I'm at least going to try. I'm praying that I'll be patient enough that when it's written, that I can take as much time as it needs to try to get into that venue. I don't know. I'll probably need to find an agent and all of that kind of stuff.
Wow. So something like HarperCollins, are you
thinking? Yeah, something like that.
Oh.
HarperCollins, okay. I don't even know who the big ones are anymore because publishers close all the time.
Yeah, I think HarperCollins is still there.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're still in San Francisco. They might not be able to afford the real estate. I know Schwab had to leave.
Over your shoulder and see if they're there since you're in San Francisco.
I'm going to go right after this. I'm going to go and just look around and see if I can find it.
You can be my agent. Then you'll get 10%.
Okay. Yeah, well, hopefully you'll get a bump on your books. I mean, I wouldn't expect too big of a bump. But, you know, I mean, not 100,000 copies or anything like that, but maybe 99,000.
Well, you know, 000. 9 copies will be good. I can take my wife out for coffee, which is the dream.
Well, we've enjoyed talking to you so much. We thank you for carving out your morning to discuss these important issues. Problem. What a great topic, Jesus versus Nietzsche. Adam, do you have anything else you want to say or ask?
No, not much. I guess I was going to maybe, you know, take it in terms of the angle of you know, are we in like a Nietzschean moment or an increasingly Nietzschean moment, you know, in our culture right now, where, you know, and I think a lot of, you know, Nietzsche's just his criticisms of Christians and broadly religious people, I think, are, you know, really hit home.
Yeah,
I think there are certainly moments of opportunities for self-reflection on some of the accusations that he's made, and some of them are real. They're good insights, and I think, you know, certainly Greg is onto something here when this notion of flourishing and the good life, it's in our culture, I think, is there's a conflict of visions that's going on right now. And the church has not done a very good job of living out and articulating the alternative. And the alternative is the media and everybody else has, outside the church, has this caricature, but it's rooted in actual goings on within the church to make the vision of the Christian life seem ridiculous and anti-progressive and everything else. And so I think this is really important work and important direction to go. And I'm happy to see Greg going that way.
Sure. Well, we'll see how long it takes. I fully expect it to be at least 3 years before I have a draft.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because, all right.
I mean, in my mind, I'd be happy because I got to be really careful right? And do a good representation of Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Well, maybe we're in a Jesus moment. I mean, Adam said, are we in a Nietzschean moment? Or maybe we're in a Jesus moment.
I think we could become that, you know, if certain corners are turned.
Yeah.
And you're not referring to Revelation chapter 20.
No. Well, that would be a Jesus moment. but I think more and more people in the church, there are more pockets of people who are engaging in really fruitful ways and embodying the life of discipleship. You know, and it's kind of a ground movement. It's not even a movement, but so for example, if you're an artist, if you're a real artist, not like an amateur or a hack, I'm a hack when it comes to playing guitar. There's never been a better time to be an artist and a Christian, because there's more and more pockets in the church that take real art seriously and allow artists to explore and see the vision for that kind of thing. And these are things that are hopeful in my mind. So we could, on one hand, we are in a Nietzschean moment and we may get worse, but there's always going to be, I think about Jesus' parable about the enemy who sows his seed at night. And there's always going to be healthy things growing and unhealthy things growing. Mm-hmm. And
Greg, I usually start with a warm anecdote. I'm going to end with one. For those of you who don't know Greg works in a homeless ministry at a local church in Orange County, serving homeless people. And in such a way that it's about people, not a program. It's about connecting with people. So I see Greg regularly just interacting with people that are having a real hard time, mm-hmm. and that have, they're in many ways just normal people that have had some turns that are really rough.
Yeah.
And it's just so wonderful to see that side of you. You're not just an academic. You're not just a former Yale instructor. You really do have a genuine heart for people. Anybody can come up and talk to you, and you talk to them just the same. You don't change your voice. You don't modulate
the New England accent.
Yeah. You talk to them just the same, and it's just a wonderful. So I wanted to share that warm anecdote just so people get a different sense of who you are.
Yeah. So. Well, it's also, if I want to have, I don't have a heart for the homeless, but I want to, and that's why I do it. My heart aligns with my practice. And
so your practice comes first. You're saying. Yeah.
I think, and being part of this is enlightening. Deep. Virginia and me. Mm-hmm.
That's very deep. Very deep. Yeah. I like that. Well, that shows you. You had to have your heart in the right place to some extent to put one foot in front of the other. I mean, if Vannen Wagen is correct, you have free will.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Which he does say, you do have free will.
I agree with him.
I was just tell me the answer. Where's the picture?
Yep. I wouldn't have gotten involved except for the woman at our church that coordinates the whole thing.
Yes. And, yeah. She is a one of a kind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marsha. So, she's wonderful. She is. I've never met anybody like her. I mean, I'm sure they're out there, but certainly valuable. Yeah. So we just lost one of our members too, the homeless guy, Tom. Mm-hmm. And I'm still grieving about that, to be honest with you. I think that's going to hit me for a while.
It's so hard. Since I've been involved, which has been about 7 years, 6 years. I don't know. I can't keep track.
That's a long time.
We've lost maybe five.
Oh man.
And you know, these people are vulnerable.
Yes. But, yeah. I'm glad I took a picture of them at the end of January, which apparently is right before we died. Of course, we didn't find out till weeks later because of the nature of the thing.
Right.
Just in terms of how words gets around and stuff for the folks that are having a hard time.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Greg. Thank you, guys. We'll end it here.
All right. God bless.
Bye.
Bye.